This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications that include Fast Company, Fortune, and Forbes. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article for this episode comes from Enterprise Magazine, and the title is 66% of small business owners struggle to hire, how companies are changing how they bring in new employees. Many small business owners are ready to expand their teams, but a Next research study found that most expect hiring new employees to be a challenge, and many are successfully attracting new talent with new strategies that work. In April of 25, we asked 1,500 small business owners looking to hire in the next 6 months for their thoughts about finding and bringing on more workers. The data reveals a difficult hiring landscape, including tough competition and a shortage of skilled applicants. Demand for workers is strong and evolving. For Danilo Corvilio, founding partner of Espresso Translations, hiring is a strategic move to improve turnaround times, reduce bottlenecks, and earn client trust. I am in the process of hiring two project managers, he says. We're dealing with an average of 80 to 100 projects a month. Bringing in two PMs will shave that lag in half and help us keep client turnaround times under 48 hours. Nationwide and across business sectors, small business owners are actively hiring for many roles to stay nimble and meet demand. According to our report, 22% plan to hire full-time staff, 17% seek part-time help, and others are eyeing seasonal workers and contract roles. According to Ernst & Young's 2024 Work Reimagined survey, flexible work is becoming more of a norm. Organizations are shifting from rigid full-time hiring toward more adaptable project-based and contract roles that can adapt to changing workloads and economic uncertainty. The report also notes that skill-based hiring, rather than traditional degree requirements, may help close the gap between available talent and job demands. Hiring demand is high, and many find that talent is scarce. From niche software skills to handling pressure and fast-paced roles, the bar is qualified candidates is very high. As demand outpaces supply, small businesses owners report that finding people who truly fit the job has become more complex. In our survey, more than 66% said attracting the right talent in the next 6 months will be somewhat or very difficult. Just a third thought the process would be easy. Covielio puts it bluntly, I currently need two project managers, and it's proving to be more difficult than it was last year. There are a lot of candidates, but finding somebody who can handle pressure and know software is rare. This signals a skills mismatch between open roles and available talent. Hiring isn't just filling seats. It's about finding people who can contribute, keep up, and stick around. What makes hiring so difficult? In our research, the main reason small business owners cite for the challenges in hiring is the lack of skilled applicants. Others said that they struggle to compete because they don't offer benefits, other jobs in the area are more alluring, or they can't match local wages. Another 10% report that unemployment is low in the area where they do business. How are small businesses changing how they hire? With flexible work locations, personal referrals, and better internal systems, many business owners have found that the best way to compete for talent might not be outspending, it's outthinking. Lou Haverty, the owner of Tank Retailer, says recent labor market shifts have made it easier to find good people. A big part of this is due to the overall shift of larger companies requiring employees to stop working from home and come back into the office, he explains. One of the biggest assets I can offer employees is the ability to work from home 100% of the time. These candidates also want to receive competitive compensation, but the flexibility of working from home is far and away the most important factor in their interest in our position, he says. At All Star Cleaning, co-owner Derek Christian says his employees can be his best advocates for finding talent. So many employers think people should be grateful just to work for them, but we make sure applicants understand why we're a great place to be before we start screening, he says. We like to have someone who really believes in the company call them to sell the company. Daniel Roberts, the CEO of Lava Roofing, takes a similarly personal approach. In small business, every hire matters, he says. Flexible shifts and high salaries have returned us good results. By listening to both candidates and current employees, his company built a workplace that values growth, balance, and connection, and saw turnover drop 17%. Our current employees were vocal about the importance of flexibility and clear growth opportunities. At the same time, we noticed during recruiting that candidates increasingly ask about work-life balance and advancement. Those changes helped lower turnover and improve employee satisfaction by 23%. To future-proof hiring, Roberts also builds out early connections with trade schools and local communities. That gives us early access to future talent, especially for seasonal or contract roles, he says. Translator Covilio supports his team with systems that prevent burnout and improve workflow. We audit and tweak processes on a quarterly basis to respect people's time, trust their judgment, and provide them with systems that actually provide support for their work. Others like tank retailers Haverty have shifted hiring criteria entirely. Initially, I was more focused on the employees' familiarity and understanding of our tank and truck equipment products. What I found was that it was more important for an employee to have a positive and engaging personality. Our next article this week comes from Fast Company magazine, and the title is Retirement Legislation Setting Small Businesses Up to Fail. Small firms want to attract and retain employees, but government initiatives shouldn't work against them. As a wave of state-level retirement mandates quietly rolls out across the country, most small businesses aren't prepared. More than 30 states have proposed mandates that would require small businesses to offer a retirement plan, and 10 states already have active state-sponsored retirement plans. California, the largest state economy, is leading the charge. By the end of this year, all California businesses with at least one employee must offer their employees a retirement benefit, either a 401k or enrollment in the state-run CalSAVERS program. By the end of 2025, those that don't could end up paying fines of up to $750 per employee, with more penalties added annually until they comply. That would be troubling on its own, but in a recent guideline survey of California small business owners, 75% weren't familiar with CalSAVERS and 65% didn't know about the fines. While the intention behind the legislation is good, the execution is falling short. Expanding access to retirement savings is important. About 7.5 million Californians lack access to a workplace retirement plan, and most of them work for small businesses. But when 98% of firms in the state have fewer than 100 employees, poor execution turns into a statewide problem. What's happening in California is just the beginning. For small business owners across the country, this is a preview of what's coming next. From hidden compliance traps to unexpected penalties. The result? Policies meant to help workers are instead creating confusion, compliance headaches, and financial risk for the country's most vulnerable employees. A system designed without small businesses in mind. Many small business owners I talk to want to help their employees and offer retire benefits. But they're also stretched thin, juggling HR, payroll compliance, and now a state-level mandate that comes with little warning and even less education. In Guidelines survey, 70% of California small business owners said managing a 401k is too complex, and 51% said it's too expensive. Yet most had never heard of the Secure 2.0 tax credits, which can cover 100% of the administrative cost of a 401k for the first 3 years. That's a clear failure in communication. So instead of unlocking access, these well-intentioned policies are creating traps, rules most businesses don't know about, and fines they can't afford. The fine print matters. Meanwhile, many small businesses are defaulting on state-run programs like CalSAVERS, which are designed to be a simple option but not necessarily a long-term solution. These programs don't allow employer contributions and come with limited plan options. A According to Guideline Research, 47% of employers who tried CalSavers shared that their employees thought the setup and management were difficult to use. That's why many employers nationally are opting to offer their own 401k plans instead. It's not because they have to, but because they want to attract talent, retain employees, and build long-term loyalty. When the playing field is level, meaning tax credits, modern tech, and low-cost plans are accessible, small businesses can offer big company benefits. So what should small businesses do now? Whether or not your state has a mandate, it's worth paying attention to what's happening in California. Here are some helpful tips for any small business owner. Check your state's retirement rules. You might be surprised to learn what's already in place. Consider your options. You don't have to default to a state-run program, especially when a private 401k could cost less than what you think. Review federal tax credits. If you qualify, you might get your plan fully paid for over the next few years. And finally, don't wait for a fine to start planning. Retirement benefits are becoming important and as cost of doing business. It may provide a competitive edge in hiring. Finally, mandates shouldn't be a minefield. Retirement access can be critical. But when small businesses are blindsided by mandates, missed deadlines they didn't know existed, and face unexpected fines, we're not expanding access, we're undermining it. For small businesses to succeed, we need to design policies with that reality in mind. That means better communication, simpler solutions, and real financial support, not just penalties. Because when small businesses thrive, so can their employees. Our next article comes from Business Insider magazine, and the title is, "We Moved to Small Town in Oregon to Save Money. We Love It, but It Has Its Downsides." In 2023, my partner and I left Los Angeles and moved to a more rural part of Oregon to save money. We spend less on rent, groceries, and activities, but often have more limited options. Our internet and garbage services have been surprisingly frustrating, but we love living here. Back in 2022, we were a childless, broke but not poor filmmaker couple in Los Angeles. We adored our Koreatown apartment, but between soaring rent, gas, utility, and grocery bills, we were truly scraping by. With our dreams of financial stability and having a child in the next couple of years, we decided it was time to leave LA, and we were able to work remotely, so we had the flexibility to do it. In July of 2023, we packed our dog and belongings into the F-150 and made a move to a small town in rural Oregon. One reason we chose Oregon is that I lived there before and felt confident our dollars could go further here, especially in a smaller, more remote town. Although our rent isn't quite as low as we'd hoped, living here is decidedly cheaper than LA. Plus, many properties here have way more outdoor space, which is a huge value add, especially for our dog Stella. Although Oregon is not immune to current inflation, our groceries are still more affordable now. What's more, food quality is often better since we have easier access to locally grown produce and lots of farmers markets. That said, our options can feel a bit more limited since there are only two grocery stores near our home and absolutely nothing like a Whole Foods, which was everywhere in LA. Beyond the basics, there are other trade-offs going from a big city to a small town that I hadn't considered before moving. The main one is that leisure activities are generally cheaper, but there are far fewer of them. Going out for drinks sets us back way less than it did in LA, but there are only four bars in town, and only two are worth the visit. Thankfully, outdoor leisure here in the Pacific Northwest is plentiful, mostly free, and requires almost no commute. Even so, we've run into a few extra costs and higher service fees. Although living in a major city can get expensive fast, our more rural life has still come with costs and inconveniences we weren't anticipating. For example, reliable internet is not guaranteed in our area. Our first Oregon house wasn't set up for internet at all, and it took months to get fiber internet installed. To survive the first few months after the move, we paid through the nose for high-powered mobile hotspot. Our garbage service is also significantly more expensive than it was in LA, in part because our local provider has to travel further for collection and disposal. At our first house, trash service cost us a whopping $70 a month, far more than it ever did in LA, Worse, the garbage truck couldn't drive down our narrow gravel road, so we had to drag our trash can some 200 yards each week. Still, we're grateful to be here, especially now that we have a kid. Our daughter was born this past January, and walking her around the sleepy streets of our charming little town has been an experience I know we'll cherish forever. We feel lucky we can make a living as filmmakers without living in LA. After all, making this kind of move wouldn't have been possible for many families, as finding work in such a limited commercial pool is vastly more difficult than in a city. I'd be lying if I said I don't miss La La Land's never-ending stream of entertainment, cultural events, and unparalleled people watching. But if I had to make the choice to move to the country again, I would. Overall, our new small-town life has saved us in more ways than one. Money, stress, hours of sitting in traffic, and time spent deciding between too many options for just about everything. And as the cherry on top, we now get to be woken up not by an alarm clock, but by our neighborhood rooster every single morning. We may not be small-town folks forever, but for now, we're home. Sticking with Business Insider, our next article is called "We Visited Three Target Stores to See Why the Retailer is Struggling." Target has struggled to grow sales in recent years as competitors pull ahead. Some analysts and customers have remarked that the in-store execution is not hitting the mark. Business Intelligence revisited three stores across the U.S. to try to get a sense of what the retailer is doing right and what it could do better. On paper, Target is struggling. Shopping in some of its stores offers clues as to why. The retailer has reported lackluster financial performance over the last 2 years. Its sales have struggled to grow while companies like Walmart and Costco have posted strong gains. The Minneapolis-based retailer's growth soared during the pandemic years, but it has since reported declining comparable sales in 5 of the last 8 quarters. Visits are also down this year. Target said foot traffic fell 2.4% year-over-year during its first quarter. Data from the foot traffic analytics firm Placer.ai suggests the decline at Target has been starker than at its rivals. In each of the past 4 months, Target's traffic was down from the year before, while Walmart's was mixed and Costco notched gains, according to the data. The general state of the stores has been a key issue for analysts and many customers on social media. By some accounts, Target is no longer as fun to wander around in while loading up a cart. The traditional mantra of the Target trip is that you go in for toothpaste and you come out with many, many other things, said Global Data retail analyst Neil Saunders. That necessitates a good, strongly executed store environment. So when that falls short, it reduces basket sizes, it reduces conversion, and it pushes down the value for money perception as well. In recent weeks, BI reporters visited three locations across the U.S. multiple times to better understand the state of its stores: Madison, Wisconsin, Ventura, California, and Washington, D.C. The shopping experience varied between the locations. One seemed well-stocked and fairly busy with customers. Another showed some signs of low foot traffic, and a third, a newer format for Target, seemed to be understaffed and had lots of locked-up products. Here's what we saw. Target does get some stores mostly right. The Target on Madison's Near West Side is arguably a crown jewel of the retailer's nearly 2,000 U.S. stores. The location serves families from surrounding neighborhoods and students from the nearby University of Wisconsin, two audiences that are Target's bread and butter. If the company is going to get any store right, this should be one of them. On recent visits, BI saw that the parking lot was active and not overly full. The store appeared to be reasonably well-staffed. A group of employees gathered one morning near the entrance for a quick meeting and talked about setting up seasonal displays. During an afternoon visit, 3 of the 8 staff checkout lanes were open, as were all the kiosks in the self-service area. Some of the shelves in the low-priced Bullseye Playground area were empty, though it wasn't clear whether this was due to seasonal changes in the selection or because items were sold out. Clothing displays were tidy and well-organized. The floors of the shoe aisles were clear of clutter from shoppers trying on different sizes. Several small groups of shoppers were in the store, and none seemed to be in any particular rush. It seemed like the kind of shopping experience Target's execs have said they hope will bring the Tarzay effect to life. CEO Brian Cornell said on a recent earnings call that the company wants to deliver everyday discovery and delight and prioritize ease, convenience, and a personal touch with every interaction. Other locations, however, appear to be getting few in-person shoppers. On three separate visits to Target in Ventura, California, about 65 miles north of L.A., BI noticed few other shoppers in the aisles. The parking lot had room to spare. At midday, there were plenty of available spaces compared with past personal visits when it was more challenging to find a place to park. The shelves, too, hinted at low foot traffic. Many of the store's displays were full and orderly, with no evidence of being picked through during the day, the way they typically are during busy shopping seasons. The store's grabby $1, $3, $5 displays near the entrance, which often features a wide and unkempt array of inexpensive seasonal, like candles and accessories, was noticeably well organized. The clothing section was remarkably easy to sift through compared to prior personal visits, when it wouldn't be unusual to find several t-shirts hanging off of hangers or discarded items on the floor. Summer items located toward the back of the store appeared untouched. Of course, well-stocked shelves and tidy aisles are great from a shopper's perspective and could indicate a level of care from the workers. Some furniture displays were empty, but that may have been due to tariff-related supply chain snarls. The SKUs, or stock keeping codes, left behind suggested the shelves had recently contained products imported from Vietnam, China, and Cambodia, which are each facing tariff increases. Another unusual clue that the store might be experiencing low traffic was the lack of a line to check out at the two available staffed lanes or the four self-checkout lanes. A Target spokesperson told BI the company's foot traffic estimates don't account for the chain's recent growth in digital sales, including delivery and pickup orders. Drive-up orders, brought directly to a customer's car so they don't have to set foot in the store, now make up almost half of Target's digital sales. Indeed, staffing levels appear disproportionately high for the limited number of shoppers. Multiple employees were spotted on the floor during each visit, either refilling shelves, tending to displays, or engaged in casual conversations near the stockroom. Saunders, the analyst, said that even though plenty of employees might be out on the sales floor, they're often occupied with fulfilling e-commerce orders under tight deadlines. They are very, very thinly stretched, Saunders said. And finally, a visit to a small format Target store revealed some challenges facing the chain. One Target store in Washington, D.C. shows some of the biggest challenges the chain faces. The location is one of the small format stores that Target started opening over the past decade. While typical suburban Targets are around 125,000 square feet, this store is about 23,000. The smaller size has allowed Target to open stores in dense cities and other areas where opening a typical big box isn't practical. Target executives have said Cleveland Park, the D.C. neighborhood home of the store BI visited, is one such dense place. On recent visits, though, BI saw issues with shopping at the mini Target. A wide range of items from men's socks to deodorant to laundry detergent were locked behind glass doors. Customers could press a call button for help, though when BI tried it during multiple visits, a Target employee only showed up about half the time. The locked cases are likely an attempt to reduce theft, an issue that Target and other retailers have struggled with in the past. Yet other stores in the area, including a Giant supermarket, a local health food store, and a CVS, offered many of the same products without having to get an employee to unlock the case. At times, staffing also appeared to be an issue. While the D.C. Target had both self-checkout kiosks and person-powered checkouts, there were times when BI visited when no one was immediately at the register to ring customers up or assist with a pickup order. During one visit, BI saw a customer wandering around as she looked for an employee could help her buy a gift card, something that Target's self-checkout stations can't sell. A Target spokesperson said that the retailer had spent last year adding more checkout stations staffed by people. At the same time, the company has added express self-checkouts line for customers with 10 items or fewer. When BI visited the store, most products were in stock. A few areas, such as a locked case for Apple accessories and the kitchen appliance department, had bare shelves. While a normal Target would be more likely to have a wider array of alternative products for shoppers in such a situation, in a small store with a narrow product selection, out of stocks increase the chance that shoppers will leave without buying anything. Overall, it's a mixed bag for Target. The three visits suggested that Target is not in any sort of crisis like the ones that have wiped out many other retail brands in recent years. The stores we visited were clean, the merchandise was usually presentable, and staff were mostly available, and the shopping experience was generally pleasant. At the same time, the assortment is not especially exciting, and the prices aren't meaningfully better than those at a competitor. That might not be enough to win over shoppers in 2025, who are increasingly picky about finding good deals or at least a reason to splurge. One of the issues with Target is really has lost its focus, as a lot of other retailers have increased and improved their focus. Target recently created an enterprise acceleration office to deliver faster progress on its growth plan, said a May announcement that Target spokesperson referred BI to. The effort will include using technology to better manage Target's inventory. For example, CFO Michael Fitticle said on last month's earnings call. Meanwhile, other major retailers are investing heavily in delivering the most convenience, think Walmart, the best prices, think Costco, or the biggest surprises, think TJ Maxx, or a combination of those things, think Amazon. There are areas that Target continues to struggle in as it looks for ways to grow its revenue and store visits. It's not an existential crisis for Target, Saunders said, but they need to get out of this nosedive and at least get the plane on a level heading. Sticking with Business Insider, our next article is entitled "The Lesson I Learned When My Friend Won the Lottery." It started with a Facebook message. "Hey," it said, "I'm going to be in your area soon, and I'd love to see you and your family. Pick your favorite restaurant. Price doesn't matter." It was from an old friend. We'd been close in college, then life happened. We moved, changed, and grew up. The connection faded gradually, like a song fading out. Every now and then, I'd see her name in a comment or a like on a photo, and a flicker of recognition, then silence again. When her message arrived, it felt like opening a letter from another lifetime. I read it twice, and then I chose a restaurant. The dinner turned into something more. I gave her the address of a local restaurant, the kind of place we reserve for birthdays or anniversaries, cloth, napkins, candlelight, and a wine list that is as thick as a novel. My friend arrived with her wife and child. She hugged me like we'd just seen each other last week, and then we started ordering. Appetizers, entrees, desserts, a round of martinis, then more appetizers, more laughter. She waved off the prices like they were a nuisance, a background hum. The table filled, and so did the space between us. We passed plates, clicked glasses, and talked like old friends who had finally pressed play on a paused story. When the check came, she didn't flinch. She simply handed over her credit card. Then she passed me a generous gift card for the same restaurant. I held it in my hand for a second. The gesture was so unexpected and so generous that I didn't quite know what to do with it. I looked at her. "Okay, what's going on? Why are you doing all this?" For half a second, doubt tried to creep in, that little inner voice that questions kindness too freely. What's the catch? I wondered if this was leading up to a multi-level marketing pitch. She just smiled and told me she won the lottery. She didn't mean metaphorically. She meant the literal lottery. It wasn't private island money, she said, but it was enough that her family would never have to worry, enough to redraw the shape of their future. But instead of disappearing into luxury, my friend had done something quieter and, to me, more extraordinary. She made a list of people who had been kind to her, people who had made her life feel a little less heavy. "I just wanted to do something good for the people who were good to me," she said, "and you were always good to me." That was the part that undid me. Not the meal, not the gift card, not even the wild, dazzling fact that she'd won the kind of money that would change her life. It was the remembering. The fact that when she looked back on her life and traced the outlines of kindness, my name surfaced. Until then, I didn't know I'd been a light, even a small one, in somebody else's sky. We're often told that kindness should be given without expecting anything in return, trusting that it will matter in some way. But what a gift is to know that it truly did, to be remembered not for your accomplishments, possessions, or status, but for simply by being kind. I shared the story online and something surprising happened. I wrote about the experience on Threads, thinking it might touch a few people. Instead, it bloomed. Stories poured in from strangers sharing what they'd do if they ever came into the money. The responses weren't about big, flashy purchases. They were about generosity, paying off a friend's student loan, surprising a single mom with a year of groceries, sending a teacher on a vacation. It was affirming that people still believe in taking care of one another, and even just the fantasy of it was enough to bring people together. The thread warmed something in me I hadn't realized had grown cold. In a world where the gap between the ultra-wealthy and the rest of us seems like a canyon, this felt like a bridge. I still think about that night. That night with her has stayed with me, not because of how extravagant it was, but because it was intimate and thoughtful. It's my reminder that kindness lingers. When we left the restaurant, the evening air felt warmer. My family walked a little lighter. We talked about the food, but mostly we talked about my friend and about what it means to tell people they matter. That moment planted something in me, a quiet vow, to remember the people who've held me up, even in fleeting ways, to reach out before the moment passes, to let others know that they were significant. Just because sometimes the most extraordinary thing isn't winning the lottery. It's realizing you were someone worth remembering. Once again, remaining with Business Insider, our next article has a title, U.S. Debt Crisis Outlook, Ray Dalio, Ken Rogoff, Neil Ferguson's Warnings. Top experts are sounding the alarm about a potential debt crisis, Goldman Sachs said. The bank interviewed three economy pros about their outlook for the U.S. fiscal situation. The top insights from Ray Dalio, Ken Rogoff, and Neil Ferguson are detailed below. Investor concerns over a swelling government debt load were soothed last week, but some experts say the U.S. isn't out of the woods yet. Goldman Sachs spoke to three top economic experts about rising debt levels in the U.S., and all three said they were worried about an impending debt crisis, particularly when considering the effects of President Trump's GOP tax and spending bill, which has been estimated to add trillions to the budget deficit over the next decade. That reflects a slightly more pessimistic view than the market. After a scare last month, demand for long-dated government bonds was strong this week. It was a sign that investors are feeling more comfortable about the fiscal situation in the U.S. after showing nerves last month after Moody's downgraded U.S. debt and Trump's tax bill began making its way through Congress. Here are the top points each of the experts had to make. Ray Dalio. The billionaire hedge fund manager says he sees three factors determining the outlook for the U.S. debt. First, how much government pays on debt interest relative to its revenue. If interest payments keep rising, it can unacceptably prevent the government from spending money on other things. Second, how much debt the government needs to sell relative to demand. If the government needs to sell more treasuries than people are willing to buy, interest rates will have to rise. That provides a more attractive yield to investors to hold on to U.S. debt, but high rates also hurt markets and the economy. And third, how much money the central bank needs to print in order to purchase the remaining debt. If demand for U.S. treasuries is especially weak, the Fed can step in to purchase bonds to keep the government funded. If it has to print more money to do so, that can raise inflation and bring the value of the U.S. dollar down. One can easily measure the signs of deterioration and see movement toward an impending debt crisis, Dalio, who has long warned of troubling debt, said. Such a crisis occurs when the constriction of debt finance spending happens, like a debt-induced economic heart attack. To prevent a crisis, Dalio said he believed the government should reduce the budget deficit to 3% of GDP. Reducing the debt could cause interest rates to decline around 150 basis points, he estimated, reducing interest payments on the national debt and stimulating the economy. Next, Ken Rogoff, Harvard professor and former IMF chief economist. Given Trump's current agenda, Rogoff thinks the U.S. will likely enter a debt crisis within the next 4 to 5 years. That's faster than the 5 to 7 year timeline he predicted prior to Trump's reelection. The notion that debt is a free lunch and that has to be pushed by many economy watchers is absurd. Today, larger deficits on top of already high debt levels is setting up for a crisis that will necessitate a significant adjustment. Rogoff thinks the debt crisis could play off in two ways. First, inflation spikes and results in an economic shock. Exactly what that shock will look like is difficult to say, but it will likely be more painful than the COVID inflation shock that precipitated only relatively minor adjustments in bond markets. Second, the government can manage the debt by keeping interest rates artificially low and restricting capital flows, but those measures will hurt economic growth and essentially serve as a tax on savers in the economy, he said. Investors have long been concerned about the U.S. debt, but the outlook is especially worrying now because the long-term interest rates are going through a normalization from low levels that stretch over the past decade. People need to recognize that higher interest rates are here to stay and that a return to the low-rate era of the past might be wishful thinking. And finally, Niall Ferguson, historian and Harvard researcher. Ferguson thinks a crisis could be triggered by a military challenge that results in the U.S. losing its position as a global superpower, and it goes deeper into debt. The British-American financial historian says his favorite gauge to determine how unsustainable national debt was is when a country spends more on interest payments for its debt than on defense. That rule, which he calls Ferguson's Law, now applies to the U.S., which spent $1.1 trillion on interest payments on the national debt during the 24 fiscal year, according to the Treasury Department. That's more than the $883 billion approved that year for defense spending. Nearly every nation that has violated Ferguson's Law has lost its status as a great power in financial markets, he said. Any great power that pursues a reckless fiscal policy by allowing the cost of its debt to exceed the cost of its armed services is opening itself up to a challenge. The U.S. is just the latest great power to find itself in this fiscal jam. The U.S. has been able to borrow as much as it has through now with no issues, in part because the U.S. dollar remains the world's reserve currency, and investors still see treasuries as risk-free. Ferguson said, meaning that they have faith in the U.S. ability to make good on its payments. But that already appears to be shifting, he said, pointing to investors around the world shedding their exposures to U.S. treasuries and moving away from dollar-based assets. I've warned that the U.S. is on an unsustainable fiscal path for 20 years now, and so at times have felt like a boy who cried wolf, he added. Our next article, once again from Business Insider, retired boomer lives on a houseboat to save money and stay active. The idea of living on a houseboat felt like serendipity. I retired at 51 from my teaching career as a reading specialist. I had never been a boater or a boat captain or anything, but one day in 2009, a couple of friends were in my living room talking about this funky Washington, D.C. boatyard down on M Street. My spirit was attracted to that. When I drove down by the water and saw those boats at the marinas, I was like, oh yeah, I'm doing this. Soon after, I sold my house, paid off the mortgage, bought my houseboat in cash, and then started my adventure. It was right after the market crash, so I sold my house, which I had been living in for 15 years at a loss, but I was able to buy the houseboat for roughly $84,000. I knew the decision to move would cut my living expenses, and I no longer wanted to have a mortgage. Lucky for me, if you have a pension, you don't even have to think about a 401k. I don't have any savings, but my Social Security and teacher's pension added up to almost $5,000 a month, which is comfortable for me to live on. I keep an accounting book and I write down all my expenses. The fee to dock my houseboat is $275 a month. Then I need to afford groceries and utilities. Praise God that I'm in excellent health. If something happens, I put it on my credit card and then I pay it off. I'm disciplined with that. I'm paying toward my next financial goal to be totally debt-free. Boats can have more expenses than houses sometimes, and after I got settled here, I had to pay several thousand dollars to fix the roof, the air conditioner, and electricity system. I paid for those repairs with my credit cards, and I'm hoping to have it down to zero by the end of this year. Once that's done, I'll have an extra $2,000 a month of spending money. I live an alternative lifestyle, and I don't have children, and I'm not married. But I have my routine. I go to the gym, I fill up with a few gallons of fresh water at a natural spring off Route 488. I cook my hot plate or grill and I run my errands. I also teach a few local children how to read. I don't charge the families anything, but it gives me a sense of purpose. Even though I'm at this later stage in my life, I can still say, oh, I have something to do today. I don't feel lonely. In my early years, I was the ultimate party girl. I loved to go to bars, listen to music, and go dancing. Now that I'm a little older, I wind it down a bit. I talk to friends, I go to social events held by my boating association, and I go once a week to a nearby jazz club. I would tell anyone planning to retire, be open to new experiences, cultivate your imagination, and ask yourself, gee, where would I want to live? What's important to me? The houseboat has absolutely been an adventure for me. When I moved in all those years ago, the D.C. area had a giant snowstorm. It was like a foot above my knees. I had to shovel the dock about the length of a football field, but I felt so proud of myself. I felt so alive. I literally think living here keeps me young. I'm happy with how my life and my people in it. From my childhood, I've always loved nature, and I see eagles and ospreys and gray and blue herons and little turtles on the boat every day. This is my dream come true. Our next article comes from BuzzFeed, and the title is Small American Business Owners Are Sharing How Tariffs Are Affecting Them. When tariffs on Chinese goods spiked dramatically, peaking at over 100% in some cases before recent reductions, small business owners across America found themselves facing an impossible math problem. From toy designers to computer repair shops, countless entrepreneurs discovered that products they depend on, and that simply aren't made anywhere else, suddenly became prohibitively expensive. When you toy maker in China, a manufacturer of indoor playground equipment, asked how U.S. small businesses were handling these dramatic tariff increases, the responses painted a sobering picture of an economy under strain. Honestly, they're not able to cope. I know two people in separate small businesses in this situation who were running the numbers right at 104% yesterday. They're already in a place with not high margins, and they also have to get their product out to distributors and on to end customers. And there's a markup at each step. They're trying to increase direct-to-consumer sales to get a bit more efficient, but that's really hard. It's more likely they'll go bankrupt unless things get fixed fast. There aren't any American alternatives for the imported supply, and there won't be any in the future. They're doomed to fail. Next, I have a computer repair shop. Literally everything computer-related is made in China, with few exceptions, Taiwan and Mexico. Sometimes new computers are about to get real expensive. This will either surge my business, in which case we'll just lower our margin on parts and maintain labor cost, or people are going to pay out the nose for a new computer. Third, I've just had to place an order for $80,000 worth of equipment to be produced, specialized gear only made in China. The budget was around $110,000 total, now maybe $150,000. It will hurt if this level or worse isn't in place when it's ready to be shipped. It will take about 3 months to fabricate it all. I don't know if I have any way to mitigate this. Fourth, our selling prices are going way up. Our sales volume will suffer because our poorest customers won't be able to afford our product. It's an item for people with disabilities, and it's really sad. Fifth, my sister designs plush toys and runs her own business. She's a small operation, but it's been her full-time gig for almost 10 years. On average, her orders are around $2,000 to $5,000 toys at a time. Her latest order was flat-out canceled by the supplier. She's completely screwed. There simply isn't a viable alternative company that isn't based in China. And finally, number six, the previous steel and aluminum tariffs from the pandemic were rough. This is on another level. I don't think most people understand how screwed we are. Currently, my suppliers are trying to raise prices slowly. They're playing chicken with each other. They know they can't raise everything overnight, and they're also competing with other suppliers, and they still need to move product in order to maintain cash flow. I've been hoarding lots of inventory in preparation, but how long it will take to move that product if the economy is slow due to overall inflation? Our costs are just one aspect of being in business. If our customers are squeezed from every direction by tariffs on everything, then they don't have cash to purchase things from us. Then toss in some idiotic Doge nonsense where you eliminate millions of people from viable employment. Currently, there is a delay as the effects of the tariffs haven't yet manifested, but it's coming. It's going to be wave after wave of increases everywhere, a literal tsunami. And the ones who understand this feel like people jumping up and down saying there's a big wave coming and everybody is just walking around blithely. Number seven. I'm about to close shop after doing it as my exclusive job for 10 years. It's screwed. Number eight, I have a $48,000 order that I placed 2 days ago just before the latest China tariff increase. haven't paid the deposit yet and now reassessing the move, considering, one, reducing the order size just not to have such a large bill come due in 2 to 3 months, and start seeking other suppliers in lower tariff countries or the U.S., although I would expect that even if we found a U.S. manufacturer, the price would work out to be the same, if not higher. Two, keep the order, but start adding a tariff fee to invoices now. Three, do nothing and hope that the jerk in charge changes this move before all goods hits customs. We've already negotiated a lower price with our supplier, so not much else to be done there. We just raised our prices for the first time in 3 years to finally pass along some of the cost increases we've incurred in that time. It looked like we'd finally improve our margins over where they've been in the last few years, and now this. I just don't know. I'm so pissed off. Before this, we had a strong first quarter, and we have two new products launching in the next few months. It's so disheartening. And finally, number nine. My family runs a restaurant. If our prices for takeout containers and other small disposables skyrocket, we're going to put some behind a price increase of giving them out for free. Currently, a large takeout foam container is 20 cents. If it hits 40 cents or more, we'll tack on a 25 to 50 cent fee, depending on just how high it actually goes. Please, everyone, understand that a small mom-and-pop style restaurant only runs 3 to 6% pure profit, if that. Right now, we're at about 4%. Our next article comes from Bloomberg, and it discusses ship signal jamming in the Persian Gulf worsens as the conflict widens. Navigation signals from more than 900 vessels in the Strait of Hormuz and the Persian Gulf went awry over the weekend, creating confusion in the shipping choke point, and the fighting between Iran and Israel intensified. Starboard Maritime Intelligence and Bloomberg data showed vessels sailing in possibly straight lines in the region, zigzagging across the water or appearing onshore. The glitches, which have affected oil tankers, cargo ships, tugs, and fishing boats, among others, since Friday, increase reliance on radars, compasses, and eyesight, boosting the likelihood of collisions. The Joint Maritime Information Center, an international naval task force monitoring the area, warned on Sunday that there are instances of extreme jamming of signals from the Iranian port of Bandar Abbas. However, the JMIC said that there were no indications of a potential blockade of the Strait of Hormuz, which handles more than a quarter of the world's oil trade. This is not a good place and not a good time to have navigation systems that can't show exactly where you are, said Mark Douglas, a maritime domain analyst at Starboard. While a closing of the strait seems unlikely, this kind of widespread jamming does cause uncertainty for anybody operating in the area. On Sunday, the Front Tyne, a very large crude carrier that's operated by Frontline LTD, entered the Strait of Hormuz. Shortly afterward, its signal showed it sailing north toward Bandar Abbas, zigzagging south into the Gulf, hovering onshore, and finally heading toward Saudi Arabia. The Alondra Willow, a medium-range tanker owned by Vitol Group, also displayed erratic movements, nearing Bandar Abbas on her way out of the Gulf. The Pegasus, a Suez Max operated by Pantheon Tankers, has been displaying locations on the Iranian mainland since Monday morning. Frontline, Vitol, and Pantheon didn't immediately respond to requests for comment. The Strait of Hormuz is the gateway to the Persian Gulf, where major oil-producing nations, including Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and Iran, load up tankers with crude and send them out via Hormuz to their end buyers. After Israel launched airstrikes against Iran last week, concerns that the Islamic Republic would block the choke point intensified. Several tanker owners have suspended sending their ships into the Gulf, according to shipbrokers. Forward freight agreements for a Middle East to Asia benchmark journey in July essentially bets on the future cost of moving oil on that route, increased by about 12% on Friday. Analysts have expressed reservations on whether Iran would shut down Hormuz, given its reliance on income from oil shipments, especially to China. Blocking exports from other producers could also provoke a reaction from the U.S. and its allies. Disruptions are therefore a likelier option, and Anoop Singh, a global head of shipping research at oil brokerage LTD, Hormuz is Iran's ultimate bargaining chip. As such, chips remain in the bag unless a worst-case scenario presents itself, he wrote in a note on Sunday. Our next article is from Entrepreneur Magazine. The title is, I Was Rejected on Shark Tank. Now I run a $2.5 million business. Here are five lessons I've learned along the way, the hard way. I didn't get a deal on Shark Tank, but that rejection forced me to build a better company. Here's how I turned that loss into a $2.5 million in ARR and the lessons you can use to scale smarter. Years ago, I walked onto the set of Shark Tank thinking I had it all figured out. I'd built an e-commerce brand and website from scratch, had revenue, traction, and a mission. I left without a deal and a bruised ego. But that moment ended up being one of the best things that ever happened to me. Today, I've built four companies, including a fast-growing hiring software business that generates more than $2.5 million in annual recurring revenue. It's been used by over 5,000 small businesses across the country to find and hire better candidates without needing a full-time recruiter. The truth? Most of my biggest breakthroughs came from the mistakes I made along the way. Here are five of the hardest, most valuable lessons I've learned and how you can apply them to help grow your business faster and smarter. Number one, visibility is worthless without readiness. Always be recruiting. After Shark Tank aired, our website crashed. We had thousands of visitors, emails, and online orders, but I didn't have the hiring bench or systems to capitalize on the moment. We were scrambling. I had no recruiting pipeline, no onboarding playbook, and no way to scale our customer support. Now I recruit like my life depends on it because it does. Whether I'm actively hiring or not, I keep a running list of A players I want to work with. We invest in structured scorecards, always sourcing, and internal referrals. If you're waiting until you're desperate to hire, you're already too late. Second, scaling without culture is just accelerating toward collapse. At one point, I was hiring fast to keep up with demand. I brought in people with the right skills, but not the right values. What followed was tension, communication breakdowns, and a toxic undercurrent I didn't notice until my best team member quit. It crushed me. The feedback was exactly what I needed. I lost my purpose at your company. We've since built out hiring software, Ava HR, around what I now call culture marketing. It's not about attracting talent. It's about showcasing the values you live by and filtering out those who won't align. Protect your culture at all costs, including slowing down your growth. Say no to customers if it's going to force you to hire the wrong people. Your culture is either your greatest asset or your biggest liability. Choose early. Third, culture fit is a lazy filter. Define it or ditch it. I used to hire people who felt like us. They shared hobbies, personalities, and work styles. It made for a friendly environment, but became an echo chamber. Now we look for culture add, people who share our core values but challenge our assumptions. We define these values with precision and assess candidates against them with structured interviews and peer reviews. If you're hiring based on gut, you're gambling. Define what you stand for and measure it. Fourth, you can't delegate hiring until you master it. One of my biggest early mistakes was outsourcing hiring before I had a repeatable system. I handed off interviews to managers who had no framework and no clear definition of success. We paid the price in bad hires, low morale, and wasted time. I eventually built out our entire process, job scorecards, interview kits, and compensation frameworks, and only then did I delegate it. Today, we train every hiring manager to use the system. It's our operating manual for building high-performing teams. You can't scale what you haven't documented, period. And fifth, if no one's challenging you, you've built the wrong team. For years, I thought harmony meant progress. I surrounded myself with people who agreed with me or at least didn't push back. But businesses don't grow in echo chambers. Today, I make it a point to hire people who respectfully challenge my decisions, ask hard questions, and think differently. It's not always comfortable, but it's always better. If you want to build a great company, hire people who make you uncomfortable in the right way. Your failure may be your best future asset. I didn't get a deal on Shark Tank, but that rejection forced me to rethink everything: my pitch, my positioning, my process, and most importantly, my leadership. It was a gut punch and exactly what I needed. That humbling moment didn't end my journey, it redirected it. Over time, it led to the creation of a software company that now generates millions in revenue and helps thousands of small businesses compete for top talent. So if you're in a moment that feels like failure, don't panic. Document it. Reflect on it. Dig into what it's trying to teach you. Every mistake, misstep, and missed opportunity is raw material for something better if you're willing to learn from it. Your failures won't define you, but how you respond to them will. Those are the moments that shape the next version of you, the version that builds something stronger, smarter, and more resilient. And our final article for this week is timely in terms of being current events. It comes from CNBC, and it was just released. It says that Iran says in diplomatic messages that it wants to negotiate. Iran has sent urgent back-channel diplomatic messages to Israel and the U.S. that it wants to end the hostilities and is willing to negotiate the status of its nuclear development program, contingent on the U.S. not joining the attacks, the Wall Street Journal reports in a story from Dubai in the UAE. The signals from Tehran have come through friendly Arab nations as intermediaries. Messages to Israel from Iran have stressed the mutual interest of both sides in containing the violence, the journal said. Persian Gulf states have urged the U.S. to pressure Israel to negotiate, but Israeli leaders have little incentive to halt their assault before doing more to destroy Iran's nuclear sites and further weaken the theocratic government's hold on power. Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is increasingly isolated after the deaths of key generals, including much of the top echelon of Iran's air force. But damage to nuclear facilities have been modest, the journal said. Talks that had been scheduled for this weekend between the U.S. and Iran in Oman over the status of the Islamic Republic's nuclear development program were scuttled in the wake of the attacks.